From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a look at how the revolving door works. We'll take a look at the Carlyle Group and former President George Bush. Then, how the tobacco companies work with organized crime and drug dealers to market black market cigarettes. That's one in three exported cigarettes. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, the former chair of Alcoa, has decided to keep $100 million in company stock and options. And a look at the USS Greenville that rammed the training fishing boat of the Japanese. We'll talk with a woman who protested on the USS Greenville on the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Death penalty opponents have asked the governor of Missouri to halt the execution of a mentally impaired man who was convicted of raping and pushing two sisters to their death in 1991. The execution of Antonio Richardson also has been opposed by the mother of the victims. The execution is set for 12:01 a.m. Wednesday at the Potosi Correctional Center. The case has drawn international attention because Richardson was 16 at the time of the crime and is borderline mentally retarded with an IQ of 70. Groups like Amnesty International, the Children and Family Justice Center, the Association for Retarded Citizens, Human Rights Watch, and the European Union have asked Governor Bob Holden to spare Richardson's life. Amnesty International says Richardson would be the second person put to death in the United States in the last 40 years for a crime committed by a 16-year-old. Oklahoma executed a man in 1999 who also was 16 at the time of his crime. A new report says many states don't do enough to protect female inmates from sexual abuse. And Amnesty International also says some laws are so weak that a prisoner can be held responsible for her attacker's behavior. The human rights organization examined laws in which each state and the District of Columbia that deal with charges of sexual misconduct by guards and other workers. It finds that some states consider only certain types of sexual assault as criminal, while other states apply their laws to corrections officers but not other prison employees like kitchen staff or medical workers. This news from Santee, California. A teenager who was belittled by his freshman classmates went on a shooting rampage at a suburban high school yesterday, killing two students and wounding another 13 people in the worst episode of school violence since the mass slayings in Colorado 2 years ago. The shooting set off a day of tremendous anxiety for students and parents alike. Parents jammed phone lines and rushed to a shopping mall across the street from the high school where the fleeing students had gathered to search for their children. SWAT teams combed the school in search of bombs or other gunmen in scenes eerily reminiscent of the deadly shootings at Columbine High School in April 1999. The name of the young man who was believed to have been the shooter is Charles Andy Williams. Some said he spoke about the shooting, though they didn't take him seriously this past weekend. In London, the gay and human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell was beaten by bodyguards protecting Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe as he tried to make a citizen's arrest yesterday of the African leader during an official visit to meet a senior European Union commissioner. As Tatchell attempted his citizen's arrest, he was repulsed forcefully and left lying semi-conscious in the gutter after receiving at least three blows to the head. According to the London Guardian, Quote, Mugabe laughed and joked with one of his minders in the back of his limousine as Thatchell was beaten. Thatchell was demanding the African leader be arrested under the 1984 UN Convention Against Torture. He later told reporters, the Belgian police allowed the Zimbabwean agents to have a free go and to beat me with impunity, and yet President Mugabe is complicit in the use of torture, which is a crime under international and Belgian law. Thatchell suspects Mugabe ordered the torture of two Zimbabwean journalists. And thousands of demonstrators descended on the South African capital, Pretoria, yesterday to protest against the international pharmaceutical industry as it opened its effort to overturn a South African law aimed at easing access to AIDS drugs. The law, which has not had a chance to take effect, would give the health minister the authority to produce or import generic versions of patented drugs that have made HIV a manageable illness in the West. South Africa leads the world in cases of the virus, with over 4 million people infected. Africa overall has around 70% of the world's 36 million HIV people, positive people, but few Africans can afford the treatments that have become routine in rich countries.
I need somebody to love. Could it be anybody? I want somebody to love. Would you believe in a love at first sight? Yes, I'm certain that it happens all the time. What do you see when you turn out the light? I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. Get high with a little help from my friends. Oh, I'm gonna try with a little help from my friends. Do you need anybody? I just need someone to love. Could it be anybody? I want somebody to love.
The Beatles singing with a little help from my friends here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. That's what we'll be talking about today, getting by with a little help from our friends. An article in the New York Times yesterday called Elder Bush and Big GOP Cast Toiling for Top Equity Firm by Leslie Wayne begins by saying, during the presidential campaign last year, former President George Bush took time off from his son's race to call on Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia at a luxurious desert compound outside Riyadh to talk about American Saudi business affairs. Bush went as an ambassador of sorts, but not for his government. In the same way, Mr. Bush's Secretary of State, James Baker, recently met with a group of wealthy people at the elegant Lanesborough Hotel in London to explain the Florida vote count. Traveling with a fanfare of dignitaries, Bush and Baker were using their extensive government contacts to further their business interests as representatives of the Carlyle Group, a $12 billion private equity firm based in Washington that's parlayed a roster of former top-level government officials, largely from the Bush and Reagan administrations, into a money-making machine. We're joined right now by Leslie Wayne of the New York Times and Charles Lewis. Charles Lewis, who is director of the Center for Public Integrity. Leslie Wayne, talk a little more about just what this, I think most people have never heard of, the Carlyle Group.
Oh, good morning. Carlyle Group is a private equity fund. It's very similar to a mutual fund for very wealthy individuals. You have to have at least $5 million to invest in it. And basically what it does, it raises money. It's got $12 billion raised, and it goes around the world buying companies and investing in the companies and selling them later as a profit, at a profit. The role that Bush and Baker play, as well as a whole roster of other kind of glittering political stars, is that they are used by the Carlyle Group as door openers. They go all around the world, meet with government officials, and then the Carlyle Group follows that in, follows those meetings with employees from the Carlyle Group that then go and meet with government officials, meet with business leaders, and then begin to raise money and pitch deals in those countries. So Bush and Baker play a very critical role in getting the Carlyle name known all around the world.
Now, you talk about who the Carlyle Group represents, something that I think most people aren't aware of when it comes to insurance companies and others. Can you name the different groups?
Well, they have about 450 investors. It's kind of a roster of basic institutional investors. These would be large pension funds, large insurance companies, state pension funds, for instance, pension funds of the California State Employees, the Texas Teachers Association. The investors in the Carlyle Group are the same basic investors that invest in a lot of other private equity groups. There's nothing particularly different about the universe of investors that's in the Carlyle Group. What's different about it basically is how the Carlyle Group goes and raises its money.
You say Carlyle Empire has grown to span three continents, include investments in most corners of the world. It owns so many companies, it's now in effect one of the nation's biggest defense contractors and a force in global telecommunications.
That's correct. They've gone around the world buying so many defense contractors that they, if you put it all together, it would rank as the nation's 11th defense contractor. And I think they told me that among the Army, it's like about the 7th or 8th Army contractor. They've also specialized in buying up telecommunications companies. They focused on the defense industry and on the telecommunications industries because these are government-regulated industries. And because the Carlyle Group is based in Washington, and because they have so many former government employees working for them, they believe that they can understand how to buy and sell regulated industries better than other people. So they've made this part of their corporate strategy to go around and buy up companies in the defense, in telecommunications, and in other government-regulated industries because they feel as though they know how to manage and deal with these companies better than other people.
Leslie Wayne, can you talk about how the Bushes, both George W., the current president, and his father, the former president, have benefited from Carlyle?
The former president is an active participant in Carlyle Group. His title is is an advisor to their Asia Advisory Board. But what he does is he goes around the world giving speeches and also John Major, the former Prime Minister of England, is also working for the Carlyle Group. So you'll have a situation where John Major and George Bush will go to Saudi Arabia, meeting with the crown princes, with the kings, with important Saudi business people, on behalf of Carlyle, introducing all the Carlyle people to the big money people in the Middle East, looking for deals in the Middle East. George Bush himself gets compensated by being included in he's allowed to participate in the Carlyle investments. He can put money into the Carlyle investments. Specifically, Carlyle will give him money for taking these trips, for giving speeches, and then he'll take that money and put it into some of the Carlyle deals. With George W. Bush, it was a little different. When George W. Bush in the early 1990s was floundering around looking for a business career, the Carlyle Group put him on the board of directors of one of its subsidiary companies, a company called Cater Air, which was an airline catering company. And this helped George W. Bush because it gave him some credentials on his resume. Unfortunately, what happened with Cater Air was that Cater Air later went bankrupt and had the nickname of Crater Air, in fact. But at the time in the early 1990s, it gave a little sort of stamp of approval to George W. Bush, who really didn't have much of a resume at that time in business.
We're talking to Leslie Wayne of the New York Times yesterday, front page piece on the Carlyle Group. Charles Lewis is director of the Center for Public Integrity that follows the money trail in Washington and around the world. Your response to the Carlyle Group?
First of all, I mean, this story was just wonderful because people have seen this group kind of lurking around Washington for years and years and years, and everyone's understood that it was even growing and that it had all these officials. But Leslie's story yesterday really is the first time anyone ever put all these pieces together. And I don't think the thing that was most stunning to me, of course, was the involvement of the former President George Bush in this company. The idea of a former president going around meeting with heads of state for commercial purposes to assist a private company that happens to be the 11th largest defense contractor with business before the U.S. government while his son is the president. I mean, I think the potential conflicts here are substantial and extensive and pretty apparent. You know, we're going to build up our defense budget even further in the next few years, and the idea that there's a company that is deeply enmeshed in the Pentagon, chairman and managing director of the Carlyle Group, Frank Carlucci, has recently met with Donald Rumsfeld over at the Pentagon last month, according to Leslie Story. And what an interesting story. He claims that he was not lobbying. They do not do lobbying, and I'm sure they were talking about the weather. This is ridiculous. So anyway.
I mean, they're close friends, as
well,
Leslie Wayne.
They are close friends, and I guess they both went to Princeton or something.
We're college classmates.
You can talk about how Princeton's doing in basketball for about 3 minutes, I think. We have a situation here where there's an incredible elaborate amount, really, of coziness. But what is most disturbing to me is the lack of disclosure. Because they're not a formal, traditional lobbying firm, there's really no paper about them or very little about their activities, who they meet with, how much they're spending. Investment banks in general, financial institutions in general, many of them based in New York, this one happens to be based in Washington, hobnob with the powerful political types in Washington and do not disclose those dealings and those meetings, whereas traditional lobbying, PR, and law firms are expected to do that and legally are required to do that. So there is a disclosure problem here. We haven't known about this company really for many years, and now that you have the father, the former president, working with them while his son is in the White House, you can see why we have a need to know more about what they're up to.
Leslie Wayne writes in the Times piece, Carlyle's hoping that financing for the $13.7 billion Crusader program comes through. It's a heavy-duty tank made by a Carlyle portfolio company and other contractors. And Carlyle just lodged a complaint with the government after another of its portfolio companies lost a $4 billion contract to build a lightweight combat vehicle. Leslie Wayne.
This is a perfect example of what we're talking about, that, you know, at the time when you have Carlucci meeting with Rumsfeld in the, you know, and Dick Cheney, the three of them were meeting along with some of the other former heads of the Defense Department, here's a perfect example of a program that Carlyle is really trying to get through Congress. And it's not a small program. There's a big debate about whether this particular, it's a heavy tank, and the whole emphasis right now is away from heavy tanks. There's a real question about whether this thing is even needed. But this is a perfect example of the kind of thing that we're talking about, of all the kind of all the conflicting lines of interest over here.
So what do you do in a situation like this? You say that because it's not a traditional lobbying firm, it doesn't have to abide by the same laws. Charles Lewis, do you think it's a matter of passing laws?
Well, you know, my group mostly studies and investigates these things. We don't advocate specific laws or legislation on anything. But I think there are two things that could happen in this instance. I actually do think that former President Bush has a significant conflict problem now that his son is president. He may have done this for a few years, but now anything and everything he does is going to be heavily scrutinized, and it will raise questions about the motives of the new administration vis-a-vis the father and this company. So there is a legitimate case to be made that he should, frankly, disengage his involvement with his company. I mean, that's what you would normally do. When a president gets in trouble, usually it's their son or a brother or something that's up to, you know, controversial financial activity. It's rare that it's their father who happens to be a former president. But in this instance, that's one issue that seems apparent without a new law. That's just a common sense suggestion. But the other one is, I think you do need more disclosure. It's not just Carlyle. These financial groups and investment banks who are meeting with powerful officials in Washington and trying to change laws or buy companies or get waivers on various restrictions, those folks and their activities are just as relevant and, frankly, arguably even more significant than many of some junior lawyer in some lobbying firm, I'd much rather want to know what the head of Goldman Sachs is up to in Washington or something like that. So I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, there is a need. I think our disclosure is limited.
You also say that here you have George Bush getting money from private interests that have business before the government while his son is president, and that in a peculiar way, George W. Bush could someday benefit financially from his own administration's decisions through his father's investments. What do you mean?
Well, if the U.S. government or under the Bush administration makes some decisions that happen to favor some of these companies that are owned at the moment by Carlyle, then the portfolio and the net worth of George Bush, the former president, will rise up, and presumably the assets of this former president will follow and move to his son. And so, if there are certain major programs, but maybe some of the Carlyle companies have some stake in the missile shield thing, for example, that's being discussed. If we embark on a tens of billions of dollars new program in that area, and some of these Carlyle holdings are somehow involved in that, that's just a hypothetical. I don't know precisely that that's a possibility, but it seems like it's not crazy to look at.
And you have the added situation if the estate taxes lessened or ended,
that's right.
He gets it all.
Yeah, he basically enriches himself. This is a lot of money. I mean, one of the things that Leslie's story had was, I think you have something like 18 partners, and if it's unclear what every partner's share is, but if they're all equal, James Baker, the former Secretary of State who saved the bacon for George W. in Florida, his stake is worth $180 million. We don't know how much former President Bush is making and what his stake is, or how much, how deep he is in terms of investments. Former presidents are not required to file financial disclosures. We don't know what he's up to. We don't know how much money he's made. But it appears he's making some substantial bucks here.
Well, I want to thank Leslie Wayne for joining us from the New York Times. Charles Lewis, I'd like to ask you to stay on the line with us because your group has just come out with a new report on the link between tobacco companies and organized crime as they smuggle cigarettes abroad. 1 in 3 cigarettes that are sold abroad are sold on the black market. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, the former chair of Alcoa, has decided to keep $100 million in company stock and options. Before we turn to look at the large tobacco companies, I wanted to ask Charles Lewis, director of Center for Public Integrity, about Paul O'Neill's decision.
Very significant. Here is the Treasury Secretary holding $100 million in Alcoa stock, and he's deciding not to divest himself of this stock, and he'll be known as Mr. Alcoa all through the federal government and all their cabinet agencies when Alcoa comes knocking on their doors. It could raise all kinds of potential conflict of interest issues, and there are other Bush administration officials, Dick Cheney, for example, with Halliburton, where there was such public pressure that they did have to divest and disgorge themselves of millions of dollars of stock options because of the way it looked and the perception issues. And there are other precedents here. So O'Neill is flatly refusing to do this. And you know, and he claims that ethics officers internally in the government have told him it's okay. It may be legally okay, but it, perception-wise, it looks terrible.
You have Alcoa, the aluminum
right.
company, $22.9 billion in revenue last year, selling its products around the world,
right.
affected by many trade regulations, also as clients in regulated industries like aerospace and railroads. So how can he say he simply will recuse himself from Treasury Department decisions that have to do with Alcoa?
Well, it's a little specious. I mean, he's going to be on interagency task force. He's going to be in cabinet meetings. There's going to be national security issues involving capital flows to countries where Alcoa has investments or heavy financial presence. There's IRS as part of the Treasury Department. I'm sure Alcoa, every company has to deal with the IRS on some level. You name it, there are things that will inevitably come up, but also the other cabinet departments. I mean, a company like Alcoa is going to be dealing with Commerce and EPA and other parts of the administration, and everyone's going to know that that's the Treasury Secretary's company. Don't mess with them, and there will be a sort of a quiet, unstated understanding, and or if there isn't, it'll appear that way to the public, or it might appear that way. So, I mean, this is, you know, this is a fairly unusual flouting of public perceptions. He's not required to unload this stuff, but usually most officials do something like that. A blind trust doesn't work in this instance because everybody knows he has it, so it's not so blind. So really the only way to handle a situation like this is to sell it.
Charles Lewis, I wanted to move on now to this report that you've put out that's really pretty astounding. The Bush administration not only has deep ties to oil and aluminum, but also to tobacco interests. Karl Rove, a longtime Bush friend who now holds the title of senior advisor to the president, was a paid political consultant for Philip Morris for 5 years. Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, a lawyer for the Atlanta law firm King & Spalding, which represented the Canadian Tobacco Manufacturers Council, and Attorney General John Ashcroft and President Bush himself are also considered close friends of Big Tobacco. This casts doubt on whether the new U.S. administration will continue to invest resources into investigating tobacco smuggling, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry. The new report that is put out by your group, the Center for Public Integrity, asserts that while tobacco manufacturers often blame smuggling on organized crime, tobacco company officials at Philip Morris, at British American Tobacco, at R.J. Reynolds, have worked closely with companies and individuals directly connected to organized crime around the world. And corporate documents, court records, and internal government reports also show the companies have orchestrated smuggling networks in the United States, Canada, Europe, Southeast Asia, China, Colombia, the Middle East, and Africa as a major part of their marketing strategy. Explain, Chuck Lewis, how this all works.
Well, about a year ago, we did a report. We have a group called the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is part of the center. It's a group of investigative reporters around the world. 7 investigative reporters on 5 continents worked on this for a year. It's a 15,000-word report on our website, which is publicintegrity.org is the main site. You can get to it pretty easily that way. How it works is we did a report earlier, a year ago, establishing that the tobacco industry generally has been involved in smuggling for years and years and years. And we did that report based on internal documents that we found in England at a warehouse that was mandated by recent court actions. And in other words, as all over the world, countries you know, have taxes on cigarettes and in many instances have raised the taxes because of the health issue and other issues, the tobacco companies have gradually begun to move their product surreptitiously into the country to avoid taxes, basically, to evade billions of dollars worth of taxes. We did that report a year ago, and there were a number of government investigations launched around the world, and one tobacco official in Britain basically admitted that, yes, we do smuggle. So this report that just came out in the last 48 hours here at the center is how do they do it? Because if you're smuggling, think about that for a minute. How do you smuggle? Well, you rely on smugglers. Well, who are smugglers? Well, smugglers are usually criminal elements, and they'll smuggle anything. They don't care what it is. So they smuggle other things, not just cigarettes. And so for years, the tobacco companies have said that if there's anything like that going on, they'd like to know more about it, and they think it's terrible, and they're shocked that it's happening, and, you know, that if any of their own people are involved, they happen to be low-level types, and they're very sorry, and, you know, basically have tried to disavow any knowledge. What this report shows is, from their own internal documents, it shows that they've had a policy about smuggling, and that they have pretty directly, with the knowledge and their consent of their companies at executive levels, they have been dealing with criminal organizations that in many instances have links to organized crime. And we're talking about, you know, all the traditional groups that are involved in organized crime in general, the Italian mafia in Western Europe, Eastern European gangs, the triads in Asia, drug cartels in Colombia, motorcycle gangs and American mafia in North America. All of these folks are now moving massive amounts, massive quantities of cigarettes illegally into all these various countries, and the tax, of course, is not being paid on it. And basically, it's a wink and nod exercise, and the tobacco companies are aware it's happening, and they're making money, of course, from it.
Charles Lewis, you talk about in Colombia, for example, the use of people involved with drug smuggling, using them to smuggle cigarettes.
Well, that's right. In Colombia, there's another matter that's also, you know, laundering drug money, and it's known as the black market peso exchange. Or basically, there's a lawsuit in Colombia by the government there accusing two companies, Philip Morris and British American Tobacco, of involvement in drug money laundering. Basically, where drug dollars are laundered for clean pesos, and the way they do it is to purchase and import cigarettes and alcohol. And it's a whole elaborate scheme, but basically it involves elements that are involved in drug trafficking are also involved in smuggling of cigarettes in and washing money out. And that's the situation in Colombia.
You also talk about how when senior or mid-level executives have been charged criminally with aiding and abetting smuggling, tobacco companies often don't cooperate with investigators. Like in a Louisiana case, lawyers for one tobacco company used their connections in the Clinton administration to force the removal of a prosecutor who was pursuing a Brown and Williamson sales executive for smuggling into Canada.
Well, that's right. We spent time with tobacco company officials who, in one or two cases, are in prison right now, and they told us how it works, and they told also about how the company treated them, basically encouraging them to do everything they were doing that had just been found to be illegal, and then attempting to step back, and then when authorities wanted information, they wouldn't cough it up to the authorities. That's in the U.S., but I think that's basically the issue all over the world.
Let me bring Bill Marcy
sure.
into the conversation, who's one of the investigative reporters who worked on your report investigating tobacco companies' links to criminal organizations and cigarette smuggling.
Project manager, I should note.
Sorry?
He managed the entire project, so it's great that you have him.
And you're an investigative reporter with the Montreal Gazette. Since this issue involves Canada as well, can you elaborate on what Lewis was just talking about?
Well, what's interesting in the Canadian example, of course, is that what we saw was repeated throughout the world. But the Canadian example occurred primarily in the early 90s when, once again, Canada raised taxes in an attempt to reduce smoking. And studies show that by raising taxes, it is really one of the most effective ways of getting people to stop smoking. Of course, it also means that the market for these for cigarettes is declining, and this was alarming to a lot of the three basic companies who operate out of Canada: RJR McDonald, which is an associate of RJR, or an affiliate, R.J. Reynolds in the States, and Imperial Tobacco, which is part of the British American Tobacco Company, and Rothmans. All three of these companies during that time established basic networks which allowed them to feed smuggling into Canada through a place called Akwesasne, which is an Indian reserve that straddles the Ontario-New York border in the United States. And it was a very effective way of doing it because you had an area that had no basic legal legal force there to put an end to it, and also Indians believe that they have a right to bring goods across the border tax-free. Now, what it was established there was that criminal organizations actually met in the instance of RJR with senior officials from RJR in New Niagara Falls, where they charted out how the cigarettes would be brought to their organization and then smuggled through the Akwesasne Reserve into Canada. Consequently, literally hundreds of millions of dollars worth of cigarettes went through that area, and hundreds of millions of dollars in cash flowed back. The residue on the Indian Reserve, the effect on the Indian Reserve was very serious. It really had the effect of destroying the society in Akwesasne. Young people got involved in criminal activity. Factions were created, criminal organizations warring against other criminal organizations. You had gun battles that broke out. And consequently, a lot of Indians ended up going to jail. It also left the residue of organized crime where other things became were suddenly smuggled through that area, drugs and guns. Aliens now are a big area of smuggling in that area. So the long-term effect of all of this on the Indians in Akwesasne has been enormous, and it's been very sad to see it. At the same time, the tobacco companies made millions and millions of dollars out of it. And to date, there's only been one person who is connected with the tobacco company who's ever gone to prison over it. And he's an individual who was a senior salesman for RJR, now in prison in the States. And they consider him to have been a rogue elephant, which is absolute nonsense in the end. All of this was really orchestrated from the highest levels of that company, RJR McDonald in Canada.
If you found out about it in your group of investigative reporters for the Center for Public Integrity report, why haven't the governments, Canada, the United States, taken on these interests?
Well, it's interesting. The government of Canada last year launched a massive racketeering lawsuit against RJR in the United States. So far, the lawsuit was thrown out by federal court in Syracuse last July because of what they call the revenue rule, where one government cannot decide on the revenue laws of another government, or a court in one land cannot decide on the revenue laws of a court in another land. And this is being appealed, and we can only wait to see what happens. The RCMP have launched investigations, which have been going on for more than a year, into RJR McDonald in Canada. We don't see any results from this. I don't quite know why. Certainly in Canada, it's very similar to what happens elsewhere. Tobacco companies have a great deal of influence with the federal government. They get closely involved in lobbying the federal government. Our finance minister in Canada is formerly on the board of the company that owned Imperial Tobacco. So, I mean, you get a lot of questionable and conflicting interest involved that is very traditional with the multinational tobacco companies, and that when you look at almost every country where they operate, you will see these conflicting interests. They're very adept at forming political alliances.
There are investigations around the world,
Charles Lewis,
by a number of governments in the UK, and as I mentioned earlier, the government of Colombia is involved in civil litigation. But the question about the U.S. is a very interesting one, and if this Justice Department is capable of prosecuting this matter, given how close the tobacco industry is, very bluntly stated, to the Republican Party, which has gotten about four-fifths of all campaign contributions from the tobacco industry vis-a-vis the Democrats over the last decade, can they go after the smuggling, and will they just go for the small fish that are the smugglers themselves, or will they go up the line into some of these companies? And obviously the pressure would be enormous, not just on the Justice Department directly, but it would be enormous via Congress. Congress, which controls the purse strings of the Justice Department and the FBI and all the feds that would be involved, there would be enormous pressure to do nothing. Let's not forget that, you know, $30 million was given to members of Congress and the two parties by the tobacco interests in the last 10 years, and we still have federal policies to ensure tobacco, to export tobacco, to protect our growers from imports, and this is still a product that kills 400,000 Americans every year, but we still are aiding and abetting this industry. So the idea of prosecuting them is hard to imagine, frankly, and it's going to be very, very interesting to watch this. The numbers of cigarettes washing into the U.S. are exploding, and the street-level folks at Customs and elsewhere are alarmed at the numbers that they're seeing, and the cigarettes coming in from countries that have no logical reason to be exporting large numbers of cigarettes into the U.S. And, at some point, it becomes so apparent and so obvious that somebody's got to do something, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see how the administration handles it.
This last just interesting note that our producer, Terry Allen, just found in her searches on the internet. I should say that British American Tobacco refused to come on, and also Brown and Williamson refused to come on. But just talking about tobacco industry and where they stand, it's interesting to note that the Chilean president of the Chilean subsidiary of British American Tobacco, Carlos Carceres, is well known as a Pinochet supporter and helped lead the defense, raising the money for the defense of the former dictator. Interesting that in 1973, currently British American Tobacco has a practical monopoly of cigarette manufacture in Chile. In 73, in their plant in Valparaiso, 2 weeks after the coup, the plant was surrounded by the army and the entire shift of workers was taken off to a camp. We know what happened at these camps. Many of these workers are still alive but never received restitution from BAT, British American Tobacco. British imperialism benefited from the 73 coup, says LaborNet. It was not just the bad guy, Pinochet. He was just their tool. So these questions of how the tobacco companies have made their fortune aside from off of the ill health of people is a very interesting one to explore. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. If people want to get a hold of the report again, where can they go on the web or call?
If you go to www.publicintegrity.org, O-R-G, that is our main site for the Center for Public Integrity. And it's our publication is called The Public Eye, and but go to publicintegrity.org. Our phone number, we don't have an 800 number, but is 202-466-1300. And it's a 15,000-word report, and it links to actual tobacco company and legal court proceeding documents as you read the text. So it has original supporting material throughout what's on the web, so it's pretty interesting to watch, to read.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Charles Lewis, director of the Center for Public Integrity, and Bill Marsden, the person who led the investigation into the tobacco company's links to criminal organizations and lucrative cigarette smuggling. Thanks for being with us. Also a reporter for the Montreal Gazette. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, an interesting take on the Japanese fishing training vessel that was rammed by a nuclear submarine of the United States Navy, ultimately killing 9 people, 4 of them high school kids. Stay with us.
파이미면 28수 낮이 되면 33천 그저 등치가 어두우면 네가 날인 줄 알려무나 인경대기도 내 사실 속
You are listening to Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. The first of the witnesses at the Navy Court of Inquiry testified yesterday that a series of missteps by the crew of the USS Greenville paved a destructive path that led to the submarine's fatal collision with a Japanese fishing training boat. Admiral Charles Griffiths, who conducted the preliminary investigation, painted a picture of a submarine crew so consumed with putting on a good show for the 16 high-profile civilian guests that standard procedures fell by the wayside. The submarine set out on its seven-hour tour solely to impress these civilians, helping to raise money for a World War II naval memorial. The fatal surfacing drill was pushed back 45 minutes because Commander Scott Waddle wanted to spend more time chatting with his guests over lunch. Commander Waddle then rushed through preparations for the drill. Griffiths also said that a technician knew the position of the Japanese vessel but did not relay the information to the submarine's officers because the civilian donors were in the way. Well, today we wanted to take a look at the history of the USS Greenville, which is a nuclear fast attack submarine. I mentioned it yesterday on the program, but on August 7th, 1995, four religious peace activists calling themselves the Jubilee Plowshares East carried out a plowshares action, what they call a disarmament action, at Newport News, Virginia Shipbuilding. Among them was Michelle Nar-Obed, who ultimately was put in jail for 2 years for her act. And she joins us on the phone right now from the Jonah House community in Baltimore. Welcome to Democracy Now, Michelle.
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. So when you saw this latest story about the USS Greenville killing the nine people on board the fishing training vessel where high school kids were being trained to fish,
yes.
What was your response?
Well, my initial reaction was one of great sorrow because when the four of us boarded that submarine, we went with the hope that we would be able to warn our leaders and our government that these weapons do in fact kill. And, you know, they kill both in wartime and in so-called peacetime. And it's very ironic that the very people from whom we drew our inspiration for going forward with this action, that is the Japanese people, being it was the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we attempted to say that, you know, never again would these weapons of mass destruction kill, and it is again the Japanese people that are victimized by our weaponry.
So explain what you did on August 7th, 95.
Well, the four of us were able to go into the shipyard, and we just kind of blended in with the workers. We wore badges that clearly stated our name and our occupation, which was to disarm. Our occupation stated disarmer. And we walked by numerous checkpoints and onto the submarine, which was under construction at the time, and it was in the water, but it was, you know, the top of it was above the water, and we were able to walk onto the sub, and in a symbolic act of disarmament, with household hammers, we hammered on a component of the nuclear arsenal that would be the vertical launching tubes, which would eventually house the Tomahawk cruise missiles, which can be either conventional or nuclear-tipped. We poured our blood into the tube, and we hung up pictures of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings and prayed, and then we tried to indict the shipyard and our government for violating both international law and God's law. We were, of course, immediately indicted and then eventually convicted of conspiracy to damage government property.
Michelle Narobid, you went to jail for what, the first time for 16 months or 16 of the 18 months?
Yes, I received an 18-month sentence, which I served 16 months in federal prison. And as part of my sentence, I was also given what they call supervised release, which is kind of a form of probation. And part of the conditions of my supervised release was that I was not allowed to return to my home at Jonah House. So my husband and daughter, who were living here, and myself, in order for us to be together for a while, had to basically go into exile and try and find a place that was acceptable to the government for us to live in. We eventually did find a place, and then after some time, we all came back to challenge the ruling, and then I was sent back to prison for another 12 months.
For living in Jonah House?
For returning home, yes.
Uh-huh. And what are the grounds? Why could the government say that you couldn't live there?
Well, it's a very gray area. At the discretion of the probation officer, they can determine whether or not the place that you are wanting to live is an acceptable place, and they determined that it was not acceptable because there were other people living here and that have been involved in Plowshares actions, and they believe that I would be brought back to criminal activity by living here. What they haven't accepted is that it's the government that's involved in the criminal activity of making and threatening to use and actually using weapons of mass destruction, which we know violates international law. And in other countries where Plowshares actions have gone on, like in Scotland recently and in Britain, the Plowshares activists have been able to use international law as a defense, and they have been acquitted and are beginning to show that these weapons are, in fact, a violation.
So, Michelle, you say now you're going to be sending a letter to the Japanese government?
Yes, the four of us, we had a connection with that Greenville. We don't feel responsible for the actions that the Greenville was involved in, but we do want to send our condolences to the families that are mourning the loss of their loved ones. And I think we also would like to send condolences to the captain of the submarine, who is now going to have to live with the deaths of those nine people that died senselessly. It's just, for us, I think we would just like to let the families know that, you know, we are sorry that our action wasn't heard loud, that it wasn't loud enough or heard by our government so that this would not have happened.
Michelle Narobid, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Michelle Narobid, a member of the Jonah House community and one of the Jubilee Plowshares East, who hammered on the USS Greenville, the nuclear fast attack submarine, when it was at the Newport News shipbuilding facility, that on the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, the USS Greenville, the submarine now involved with the killing of the nine people on the fishing training vessel off the coast of Hawaii. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move into our last segment and try to catch up with the Zapatista caravan that's making its way from Chiapas to Mexico City. We're going to go now to Toluca, which is about an hour from Mexico City, to Scott Gurian, who is a reporter with community station WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's traveling with a group called Schools for Chiapas and is at the site, I believe, where a press conference is just about to take place of the Zapatista leaders. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott.
Thank you, Amy. We're now on day 10 of what's been dubbed this March for Indigenous Dignity, which is this two-week, 1,900-mile caravan route from the southeasternmost state of Chiapas to Mexico City to press for the Mexican Congress to constitutionally implement the San Andreas Peace Accords and grant inclusion of indigenous people into the Mexican Constitution. And all along the route, the Zapatistas have been stopping in numerous cities and villages in a dozen Mexican states, shoring up support from the local townspeople and publicizing their cause. So yesterday, the caravan passed through the cities of Morelia and Zitácuaro in the state of Michoacán, eventually making its way to Toluca, where the Zapatista spokesperson, Subcomandante Marcos, appeared before a crowd of about 5,000 or 6,000 people who filled the town square to its maximum capacity and responded to many of his statements with resounding applause. And in his speech, Marcos spoke of the corruption within the government and the loss of indigenous culture, and he contrasted the vast disparity between poverty and wealth in Mexico. at one point saying, quote, in this country, the only right that the poor have is to remain poor. The rich are afraid because they know that the conditions that the majority of Mexicans and not just indigenous live in are miserable, and this could provoke a people's rebellion. Well, based upon the enthusiastic reaction he received from the crowd, as well as a wide array of people who came out to hear his speech, Marcos definitely seemed to be connecting with many segments of Mexican society, and his message was certainly accepted very warmly. In fact, everywhere we've traveled, it's been quite clear that the Zapatistas have been winning in the court of public opinion. As peasants and city folks gather on roadsides, waving, holding banners, and cheering their support as the Zapatista caravan passes through each town and small village. And even here on the march itself, this wide array of support is evident as the Comandancia, the leadership of the Zapatistas, is joined by scores of journalists and supporters from throughout the Americas and as far away as Germany, Italy, Ireland, and the UK. So it's been quite interesting to meet some of these people and hear the stories which brought them here. I'm here right now with two of these people, Peter Brown, an American, and Concepcion Martinez, a Mexican, both members of the group Schools for Chiapas, which helps coordinate the construction of autonomous educational institutions in Zapatista communities, and is one of the organizers of the Little Yellow School Bus, which traveled from San Diego to Chiapas collecting and distributing school supplies. So I'm going to hand the telephone off right now to Concepcion, who I should mention is also a member of the FENTE, the unarmed wing of the Zapatista Army. And I'm going to ask her to tell us a little bit about the work of Schools for Chiapas, and then, Amy, I'll let you take it over from there.
Okay. I think today we'll only have time for Concepcion because we only have two more minutes for the show.
Okay. Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us, Concepcion.
I'm a member of the Frente, and I live in Ensenada, Baja California. We came with some compañeros to the third National Indigenous Congress with some delegates from the Indian communities of Baja California who wanted to also express their support for the march, for this Indigenous March of Dignity.
What were your thoughts yesterday as Subcomandante Marcos was addressing the crowd?
The main thought, and that should be perhaps the message for everyone, is that he is calling for a union, that we all come together and that we all continue to pressure both civil society here in Mexico and internationally, because we are all aware, and certainly in the Frente we are aware of that, that even though if Congress should pass the approve the Accords of San Andres as they are now in the form of a law initiative, it will not be enough to convert them into a reality unless we all continue the pressure.
What are you, as a Zapatista, expecting to accomplish when you get to Mexico City? Is the accomplishment just the trip, or is it the meeting with government officials from March 12th on?
Perhaps the main thing is to create awareness, to wake people up to this demand that the indigenous people are their cry for justice and liberty and democracy. We also would like to invite everybody to join and come to the caravans, to our educational caravans. There will be several caravans this summer. That would be another thing.
And
that
where will
like.
Those caravans be going?
Those caravans will be going to the two autonomous schools in Chiapas. One is in Oventic, and the other is in the community of Francisco Gomez.
And how can people get in touch? Is there a phone number?
There is a webpage, schoolsforchiapas.org.
Schoolsforchiapas.org?
.org.
Thank you very much, Concepcion Martinez and Scott Gurian, reporter for WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, joining us from Toluca, where a press conference is about to take place of the Zapatista leadership, and we'll catch up again with the caravan tomorrow. That does it for the program. We'd love to hear from you. You can write to us by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen, Anthony Sloan, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!